You can turn to Matthew chapter 14. That's where we'll be in a few minutes. It's kind of awesome when we're outside how the scriptures just sort of line up sometimes. And so in June, when we were out here last, we talked, the text was from Psalm 8, and it had to do with all of God's creation and nature and those kinds of things. And today, remember, we have a picnic following. And so the text for today is the feeding of the 5,000. So I'm going to ask for the best piece of food that anybody has brought, and I'm going to bless it and see how far it goes and see if this can be like an actionable thing for us. I'm kidding. So it's a little bit ironic, but at the same time, it's kind of fun that we can be outside and sort of maybe embody this experience a little bit from what Jesus did with the actually 5 to 10,000 in Matthew chapter 14. So if you don't have your Bibles, that's fine. Just listen as I read. This is verses 13 through 21. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so that they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food." Jesus replied, "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat." "We only have a few loaves of bread and 2 fish," they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. Then all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 baskets full of broken pieces that were left over. And the number of those who ate was about 5,000 men besides women and children. So what I want to do in the next few minutes is to give us some context to this passage of Scripture, particularly paying attention to how Jesus is coming into this feeding of, we call it 5,000, but let's just call it 10,000 because there are women and children there too. So if you back up, as we've talked about in the last couple weeks, we've been in Matthew chapter 13, and there's been some things that have happened before this, and that's what we want to pay attention to. Because Jesus just isn't dropped in the middle of this place. Jesus is entering into this place as a human being, and so he has experiences that shape how he enters into this feeding of the 10,000. If you back up into Matthew chapter 13, he spent a lot of time teaching about the kingdom of God. What he's doing on the shore here with the feeding of the 10,000, he's not teaching. It says that he's healing. And so there's a lot, there's a whole different dynamic as to what's happening here. So he's done teaching, and in Matthew chapter 13 leaves Jesus teaching. And at the end of chapter 13, it has Jesus returning to Nazareth, his hometown. And what happens when he gets to Nazareth is he tries to go into the synagogues, we'll just say. He goes back to his local church, and he gets up and he starts to teach Sunday school, and he starts to give a sermon or whatever. And everybody's like, "I know this guy. I know his brothers. I know his sisters. I know his mom. I know his parents. He grew up with me. Like, he gave me a hard time when I was 11, and I remember this." And they don't accept who he is, and they don't accept what he does, and they don't accept his words because they're so familiar with him. And so in the end of chapter 13, it talks about how Jesus was rejected by the people that knew him most. And so if you can imagine that, actually, you can imagine this. It would be like Connor getting up here and saying, "Hey, guys, I would love your support," and zero people have any interest. Because they just, I know this kid. I've seen him grow up since he was 7 years old. I remember the first week he was here when he opened the bathroom stall door so hard that he broke the hinges. That's an actual true story. Right? So Jesus goes to his hometown. He's rejected by everybody. And you know how rejection feels. All of us know how rejection feels. It's especially when it's by people who know you the most. So that's how chapter 13 ends, but then you get into chapter 14. The beginning of chapter 14, we read that John the Baptist is beheaded. And so John the Baptist, you know, is Jesus' cousin. So they grew up together too. they aren't only cousins, they're not only family, but they're close in relationship and mission. Like John the Baptist is the forerunner for Jesus. He's the one who's trying to proclaim to the people, look, this is the guy you've got to look out for. This is the one you need to listen to. And so John in chapter 14 is beheaded. And this beheading takes place and this murder takes place, and there's just such a contrast of images here. So John the Baptist confronts Herod, and Herod's in a palace. Herod has his birthday party. There's opulence. There's food everywhere. It's like what everybody would want to experience, right? And this is where a murder takes place. And so on the one hand, you have this palace. You have food. You have all this plenty. And then you have a murder. And on the other hand, then Jesus lands on the shore because he wants to be by himself. And so it's a deserted place where there is no food. And so Jesus enters into this place having been rejected by the people that he's known most and grieving over the murder of his cousin. Not only grieving the murder, but he's facing the fact, because Jesus is fully human, he's facing the fact that his future is going to be very similar to the same as John the Baptist. And so he lands on this shore. He takes a boat. He's done teaching. He leaves Nazareth. He gets on a boat because he wants to get away from it all. He needs some me time. He needs some self-care, right? And he lands on the shore, and he's greeted by 10,000 people who are needy. They're not there to hear him teach. They're bringing their sick to him. And what they need from him is for him to heal them. So this is how Jesus enters into this scene, this feeding of the 5,000. We often like emphasize this miraculous thing that Jesus does, but I think the most miraculous thing is the way that Jesus enters into this place. There's a word that describes how Jesus enters into this place. I got to find it here because it's a fun Greek word. And I'm going to butcher it, but it's fun. Here we go. Splachnidzamai, right? It sounds messy. Splachnidzamai. I like the part, right? The word there is compassion. Splachnidzamai means compassion. And it's not pity. So this is a different kind of compassion. So often when we see things and we see this as we see the news or as we read the news, as we see what's happening in the world, we feel for what's going on, but we have a distance from it. We're removed from it. This kind of compassion is completely different. It's not just one that sees and has pity on what is happening around them. This kind of compassion is one that engages in it fully. And so if you can imagine, like, I'll just say this is the norm. This is a normal emotional level for a human being, right? Jesus has now experienced the rejection of those who know him and love him. Jesus has also experienced the murder of his cousin and the grief that follows that. And Jesus is also holding on to the fact that this is going to happen to him too. And so Jesus is way subpar when we consider the emotional state that he's entering into this time, right? Believing that Jesus is fully human, we need to honor the emotions of Jesus too, right? Jesus isn't just like, oh, I'm God, nothing fazes me, right? These things impact Jesus. These things affect Jesus. This is why Jesus wants to go to a solitary place, because he needs to be alone. He needs time to grieve. He needs time to process. And what he gets when he finds himself on that shore is 10,000 people that need him. And so, splachnidzamai is a compassion that goes deep. Like Jesus taps into a level that you and I can't even tap into. Splachnidzamai, this kind of compassion, is actually only used 4 times in the New Testament. All of them are used to describe Jesus. It's never used to describe us. It's used to describe a depth of compassion that only God himself can have, that only Jesus expresses. And so Jesus enters this place, he enters this shore, and he sees the people, And Matthew writes, he has compassion on them. He feels it deep in his guts. This kind of compassion is something that's almost gut-wrenching when you think about its experience. And so Jesus enters into this place in his own emotional place, but then he sees the needs of the people and he taps into something that's much, much deeper. And he engages them with compassion. I think this is profound on a number of levels, because if you think about the Old Testament Baals and the Old Testament gods, or you think about the Greek gods, none of them have a way, none of them feel, first of all. And second of all, none of them are moved towards compassion towards the subjects that are supposed to worship them, right? Everything is required of the worshipers, but the gods stand at a whole other level. But this isn't what we see at all with Jesus. We see that Jesus is moved with compassion, that the subjects of this God actually move the heart of this God. This is not normal, friends. This is not a normal way to think of a deity. This is different. What we see here in Jesus is different. And so Jesus enters into this place feeling compassion towards the people. One person described it this way, as if we can imagine this scene and what's happening throughout the day. Okay, think of it as an ER, right? And Jesus is the only emergency room doc on duty. And there's 10,000 people there. Now, maybe not all of them are in need, right? But maybe, who knows how many, right? But there's one doctor on duty, and everybody's showing up to this place because they need something from Jesus. And so throughout the day, people are watching Jesus take one patient after another, after another, after another. And you know, if you're in the ER, you don't want to get up. You don't want to go anywhere. You don't want to do anything abnormal. You don't want to go get a break. You don't want to go get lunch. You don't want to go to the bathroom, because you don't know if your number is going to be called next, if the doctor is going to see you next. And so you sit there and you wait and you wait. And if anybody's had this experience, like, emergency room visits are exhausting. Actually, doctor's visits are exhausting. And this is what's happening with the people throughout the day. They're waiting, they're waiting, they're waiting, they're hoping, they're seeing Jesus do healing things. Matthew's not specific as to what Jesus is doing, but he says he healed many of them. And so they wait and they wait and they wait, and it comes to dinner time, and the disciples are like, okay, we need to shut down the ER. It's time to close this place, because Jesus, you're apparently exhausted, and we've got no resources for these people. And so Jesus said, no, we're not shutting this down. You need to give them something to eat. And they're like, we don't have anything to eat. We've got 5 loaves of bread. We've got 2 fish. That's all that they brought for themselves. And so this is what Matthew says then. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks, and he broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. Now, all this context, all of Jesus' emotions, the tiredness and the weariness of the people, and friends, don't diminish the tiredness and the weariness of Jesus, too. All this goes into this moment of giving thanks. I think this passage actually hinges on giving thanks. I don't think it hinges on the food. I don't think the food is the point. Jesus does something in giving thanks that I think is teaching us something. I want to read a couple paragraphs from theologian Rowan Williams. This is what he talks about in terms of helping us understand the significance of giving thanks. He says this: when we say thank you to God, we connect our experience with God as giver. We say that what has happened to us or is happening to us is somehow rooted in the gift of God. And when we give thanks in these kinds of places of need, here in the midst of needy people, Jesus is connecting the darkest place of human experience and need with God the giver. As if he's saying that even in these places, even in these places of great need, God continues to give, and therefore we give thanks. He goes on to say, this is what Eucharist means, thanksgiving. This is why it took root and became the earliest and most widespread name for what is known as Christians, for what Christians do when they participate in Holy Communion. They meet to give thanks, even in the midst of their darkest experience. I want us to think for a moment about what's happening when Jesus takes the bread and the loaves and the fishes and he gives thanks. I think this is what we normally maybe picture, maybe unconsciously picture. Jesus gives thanks, and somehow there's this miraculous trick that Jesus performs, or there's this magic pixie dust that's sprinkled upon the loaves and the fishes, and somehow it just keeps going and going and going, and this is a miracle of Jesus. Wow, stunning. But then you remember that one of the first temptations of Jesus was to take rocks and to make it into bread. And so maybe this isn't about Jesus turning in this loaf of bread into something more and more and more. Michael Gorman is a theologian who writes on the faith of Jesus. Most of the time when we talk about faith, we talk about faith in Jesus. But as we read the Gospels, it's not only that we want to have faith in Jesus, but Jesus has his own kind of faith in the Father. It is the faith of Jesus that you and I are called to mimic, to make our own faith. And it changes the perspective of how we look at Jesus, because Jesus is himself exercising faith in the Father. He's trusting who the Father says the Father is, and he's acting out of that. So what happens if we think about it that way? If Jesus lifts the bread to the heavens and gives thanks and breaks it, because he trusts that the Father is going to pour as much as is needed. It's not that he's doing something spectacular, but he is the vehicle through whom the Father pours out his blessing, which is true. It's a whole different way to think about it. Jesus draws the attention of the disciples, probably not the tens of thousands of people that were there, because there's just too many. And so Jesus is with his disciples, but he's saying, look, this is what we have, God. This is what we have. 5 loaves, 2 fishes, 10,000 and 12 people who are hungry and tired. And you know what, Father? I'm exhausted too. Thank you for providing for us what we need in our place of need. And so Jesus breaks this bread and puts it in a basket and gives it to his disciples to hand out. There's one last piece I want to bring out of this story, because it's the disciples who then hand it out. And so it's not Jesus who hands it out. Jesus isn't drawing attention to himself at all, but his disciples hand it out. And so I think it's an invitation for us as disciples to think about what it means to be the hands and feet of Jesus. But I also thought about what it might be like for the disciples as they take the basket and they start going around. And they realize, you know, this stuff isn't running out, which I think might be a little shocking. But then I thought, you know, after in the beginning, maybe the first 15 people, they're like, oh, okay. Maybe they're just portion controlling, right? But then you hit 100 people and you're like, this isn't running out. And if I was one of the disciples and I'm one of 12 feeding 10,000 people, I guarantee you one of the things that I'm thinking, even as this is not running out, is, oh man, this is going to run out soon. Because I think this is what we think of God, right? That the blessing only lasts for so long. That the provision only lasts for so long. That the enoughness only lasts for so long. That sometime, even though it seems really good and too good to be true, it's going to run out. But then they keep handing out. They keep handing out. And they're learning with every couple hundred people that this isn't running out. And I feel and I know this in my life with God. Like, God seems to supply, even for a good long time, but there's always this nagging thing in the back of my head. Man, it's going to run out soon. Boot's going to drop. Things are going to change. Crap's going to hit the fan. Something's going to happen. But the bread just keeps going and going and going and going. There is an abundance for the enoughness of everybody who is there. And that tells us something about the nature and the character of God. That the abundance of God leads to the enoughness for you and I. There will always, always, always be enough. I feel like I'm preaching to myself. I'm reminding myself that there's always going to be enough. We're not going to receive communion this morning as we normally do, because we're having a picnic lunch after this. And for those of you who didn't bring food, again, I'm ordering pizzas for all y'all. So feel free to just see me. If A, you don't like the food that you packed and you want pizza, or not too many of those though, or you didn't bring food and you want to sit around and hang out for a little bit, see me right afterwards. But we're going to experience communion a little differently, just in circles, eating whatever it is that we've brought, and being among people who are doing their best to follow Jesus, knowing that week after week, as we come around the table, so to speak, and as, frankly, we gather around any table, we're reminded again and again that God gives us enough. That God gives us enough. So I just invite us into kind of a moment of reflection and quiet as Brian comes forward, and Brian and Joe. But there's so much that's packed into this story. There's so much that's packed into this account. There's so many different ways that maybe you can experience or receive this. And so I just invite you over the next few minutes, Brian, you want to give them a few minutes before we sing anything, but just to reflect and to receive whatever you feel like God has for you within the context of this story this morning. But just know, just hear, God's not going to run out on you. Like, the literal supply of whatever it is that you need, God is not going to run out of. So let's just sit with this for a moment, and then Brian's going to lead us.